Welcome to America Strikes Back, the story of the Doolittle Raid. This program is produced by the American Veterans Center and the World War II Veterans Committee in association with Radio America. To hear this and other audio documentaries, visit www.americanveteranscenter.org. The early days of World War II proved trying for the United States military. Morale was low, with defeats at Wake Island, Guam, and in the Philippines. Eager to strike back at Japan, President Roosevelt called for a surprise air attack on their home islands. As the American military did not have the bases or the bombers to fly from China, an alternate plan had to be proposed. The coordination and execution of the task was put in the hands of then-Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle, who was already well known as an aviation pioneer.
From December 7, 1941, President Roosevelt, date which will live in infamy, through the fall of Guam, Wake, Hong Kong, Singapore, through the imminent fall of Corregidor, all of the news that we had received was bad. The U.S. needed some good news. Japan needed a setback.
I now realize how shocked the country was in 1942, in the spring of 42, and how much the Japanese had done in the Pacific. And by the spring of 42, they were about to conquer the Philippines. I can understand what President Roosevelt must have been going through. He called his admirals, top admirals and generals together and said, we've got to retaliate, we've got to fight back, we've got to prove that we can fight back. And I think he envisioned the bombers taking off from China and bombing Japan, because the distance there is not very great. But of course, we didn't have the capability in bombers to do that at that time from China. Well, then, of course, the raid came along, the Doolittle Raid of April of 18, 1942, and General Doolittle leading that famous mission and all the preliminaries ahead of time. I know what happened on April the 18th.
Mixing the element of surprise with an attack strong enough to succeed in damaging Japanese military prowess proved a difficult task. Retired Air Force Colonel C.V. Glines, official historian of the Doolittle Raid and honorary raider, recounts the details of the mission that inspired a nation on April 18, 1942.
The story, of course, is that a Navy submariner named Captain Lowe wondered if it could be done. He was on the staff of Admiral King, Chief of Naval Operations, and he broached the question to the boss, to his boss. He wondered if Army bombers might be able to take off from a carrier and get the carriers close to Japan. And that way, then, the president's wishes could be carried out.
General Jimmy Doolittle would personally see to it that they did. Before his passing in 1993, he recalls the idea that set the attack in motion.
Captain, later Vice Admiral Francis S. Lowe, conceived an idea. It was to take Army bombers off a Navy carrier and bomb Japan. He took the idea to Admiral King, who discussed it with General Marshall, who turned it over to General Arnold, and after they'd considered it, they all went to the president with the idea. The president approved. The plan was agreed to.
The thought that an aircraft carrier could support the launch of Army bombers was a completely new concept for military personnel. Jimmy Doolittle, who held a doctorate of science degree in aeronautical engineering from MIT, was assigned the task of determining the feasibility of the idea, and, if conceivable, which bomber could most effectively complete such a mission, as explained by Colonel Glines.
In today's vernacular, you'd call it a mission impossible. An Army bomber, medium bomber, fully loaded, take off from an aircraft carrier, a 350-foot deck? No, it couldn't be done. The Japanese didn't think so either. And that's why the surprise, General Doolittle, or Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle at the time, was given the task of determining if there was an airplane that could fly off of a carrier, Army Air Force bomber, to make such an attack. The B-25 was selected because it would miss the island by a few feet. The B-18 was considered, but it had too much wing spread, And the B-26 was impossible to take off. It was too fast and needed too much runway to take off. So he had decided on the B-25. If it were properly modified, could haul 2,000 pounds of bombs 2,000 miles. But the Navy had to give him some wind across the deck by the speed of the carrier. The carrier had to be into the wind, which is one advantage that the Navy pilots have always had, is that their landing strip and their takeoff strip can always be into the wind. But he was promised that they could at least get 20 knots, and if they had some wind across the deck, about 25, 30 knots, that the speed of that B-25 could be reached.
With the B-25 chosen for modifications, it was time for Doolittle to pick his crews. Stating that the mission would be very dangerous, he issued a call for volunteers only. Major General David M. Jones, then a captain and pilot of Plane 5, describes the arrival of the infamous Jimmy Doolittle and his top-secret mission.
This Colonel Doolittle showed up and talked to the group commander and got us everybody together and said, "They're coming up a secret mission that probably pretty dangerous, and you'll be over out of the country for several months, and it involves action against an enemy capital, period. Who wants to go?"
Prefacing the announcement with only the flight's inevitable dangers, Major Tom Griffin, then a lieutenant and navigator of Plane 9, recalls the reaction from the men.
They said that they were planning a trip that had unusual elements of danger, and they didn't want to assign people to it. They wanted people to know that it was a dangerous mission and to volunteer. And as far as I can remember, everybody volunteered.
Greeted with such overwhelming enthusiasm, Doolittle decided to gather his crews from the four squadrons of the 17th Bomb Group, the most experienced with the B-25 bombers at the time. This was the same unit that Major Edward Saylor, then a sergeant and engineer gunner of Plane 15, and Staff Sergeant David Thatcher, then a corporal and engineer gunner of Plane 7, had been assigned.
We got picked because General Doolittle decided to make up the crews from the 17th Bomb Group, and I was in one of those squadrons there, and that's how I got picked. And everybody was going somewhere off to war in those days, so me and some of my friends just volunteered for this. Not having any idea what it was.
Well, the 17th Group was the first group in the Army Air Corps to start flying B-25, so that's why all the Raiders were picked out of that group, more experienced.
In order to successfully launch 16 bombers from the base of an aircraft carrier, several key plane modifications had to be developed. Led by the aeronautical engineering genius of Jimmy Doolittle and the staff of General Henry Hap Arnold, the planes were immediately outfitted for battle.
At this time, I was on Hap's staff in what later became operational engineering. Part of my chore was getting peacetime military planes battle-worthy.
Because the planes were scheduled to drop their bombs in Japan and then fly to China without refueling, additional fuel tanks were required for all the aircraft. Since the bombing was to be at 1,500 feet or less, the last major alteration to the planes was the replacement of the top-secret Norden bombsight. A makeshift aiming device, dubbed the Mark Twain, was designed by Captain Ross Greening. After the planes were fully modified, the crews and planes were moved to Eglin Field, Florida, to begin the 3-week training period, beginning March 1, 1942. Here, the crews received intensive training in simulated short field carrier deck takeoffs, low level and night flying, low altitude bombing, and overwater navigation. Navy Lieutenant Henry Miller supervised the short field takeoff training and later accompanied the crews on the Hornet to their launching point. Major General David Jones, pilot of Plane 5, recalls this experience.
We ended up then, the 20 of us, down at Eglin. And, of course, that's a big reservation. And we sort of, again, there were four of us who were pre-war regulars, lieutenants. We had one guy as a captain. So there were four, and most of the rest of the people were in the group, and they'd been with us maybe 6 months or a year. Most of them were late 40 or early 41 pilots out of the flying school. And we worked pretty hard there for about a month. And we got there about the next day sort of thing, Lieutenant Miller from a Navy pilot from Pensacola, was real close to Pensacola, came over, introduced himself, and he said, he's here to help us. And on short field takeoff, and Navy protocol, customs and services and all that sort of stuff. Well, he'd never seen a twin-engine airplane, we didn't have any, know anything about a carrier. So amongst ourselves, two or three of us who were the old lieutenants went out to at Eglin's Big Reservation, and at that point, they had about a half a dozen or more 5,000-foot academy macadam strips, and they're spread all over this big damn place. So we used that field, and two of us went out there and scratched our head, and at any rate, we evolved our takeoff procedure. We'll do it this way, and then we ended up evolved our system. We went with full flaps and trim and everything, and then go to power, release the brake, and we run no more than 3 or 4 seconds, and back with the wheel clearing your belly, and the nose came up, and you'd push it forward and use your foot to hold it, and you sort of go like that start to pick up power and everything.
Major Tom Griffin, navigator of Plane 9, explains his training experience.
And some days we were out practicing our craft, in my case navigation. We flew it around the Caribbean there and that sort of thing. And the bombardiers had some practice bombardiers. We had a pretty intensive period of training there for about 6 weeks. And, of course, Davy Jones and I spent about 10 days in Washington. We lost that part of the thing. But it was a good training thing, and we were all in pretty good shape for what we had to do.
Despite some severe weather conditions that hindered flight and a series of frustrating takeoffs, the pilots were ready. Major General David Jones recalls.
On the boat, on the shore at Eglin, Hank, our Navy guy, he'd measure each time, and I'd check the guys out. He'd go around once and show them what we were doing, and then we'd measure the takeoff. And then we added weight, and we got up to takeoff weight. And in still air, we could get off the ground at about just a little under 80 miles an hour. And we were happy. As it transpired, of course, everyone had 4, 5, or 6 trials, like, we did that in a routine deal.
After the initial training period, the crews flew to Sacramento, California, with final consumption tests and navigation practices en route.
About the time the training was going well, I conceived the idea that I would like to lead this mission. And I went to General Arnold and said, General, I have the planes in good shape. The crews are on their way to being trained. I know more about the planes, having engineered the redesigns, know more about the crews, having participated in the training, and than anyone else. I therefore feel that I'm the logical man to lead this mission. And General Arnold said, well, Jim, I'd like to have you stay here on my staff. And I said, very well, sir, but I would like very much to lead the mission. He said, all right, if you feel that way about it, go ahead.
And then on the 1st of April, we flew over to the Alameda Naval Air Station and loaded up on the carrier, the Hornet. And now we knew we were heading across the Pacific for attack on Japan.
Major Tom Griffin and the other Raiders, the 16 modified bombers, and Army aircraft maintenance personnel were loaded aboard the USS Hornet aircraft carrier at Alameda Naval Air Station near San Francisco. Each aircraft carried 4 specially constructed 500-pound bombs, some high-explosive munitions, and others with incendiaries. Doolittle describes the departure of the Hornet and its naval escorts.
The task force, Navy task force, consisted of the Enterprise, with Admiral Halsey, the task force commander, had his flag on the Enterprise, the Hornet, and Captain, later Vice Admiral Michener, was captain of the Hornet. There were two heavy cruisers, two light cruisers, eight destroyers, and two tankers. While we were on board, we kept busy. I felt that it was very wise to keep the boys busy, and we did athletics and did our planning. There was a lieutenant commander on the carrier named Jurica. Jurica had been air attaché in Tokyo before the war, so he was a very handy chap indeed to help us with our maps, with our targeting, and with briefing us on Japan in general.
The interesting part on that 18 days at sea is that we had all this data that... But we had this mass of books on board the carrier, and we read all we could about Japan and from geographics and other civil magazines. We didn't have anything from the military end that was much of a help as telling us what we're going to see.
The data that Colonel William Bauer, pilot of Plane 12, was referring to was the information gathered by Major Tom Griffin and Major General David Jones in Washington, D.C. Along with maps and charts of both China and Japan, the men acquired the locations of industrial and military targets that could be selected. Here, Griffin explains the assignment, while Jones reflects on the data.
I happened to get a very interesting assignment with Davy Jones. In February, he and I were sent up to Washington, D.C., and we worked with Air Force Intelligence for a week or 10 days, getting together all of the maps and charts that our group was going to need for this attack on Japan. And we got from our intelligence the location of industrial and military targets that we could use in Japan. So Davy and I got that information. And we were the only ones in our group that knew exactly what was going to take place, but we couldn't talk to anybody about anything. Everything was very secret.
So we started looking at, as you went inland, we realized that the charts, the maps, they just didn't match. And you'd find there'd be a city, a pretty good-sized city, in this position, and in the next, the other issue of map, that was 50 miles away. 50-mile difference as far as the map's concerned. The mountain, Huchan Mountain, is 1,500 meters here, and it's 2,500 meters in this map. And so we looked at literally several issues and picked this one. And I think it was French, but I'm not sure. And we'll use this one, all right? Well, the powers that be, fine. But we didn't have time. They didn't have time to reproduce the color. So all they could do is print black and white. So we ended up with sectional charts, just black and white, period. So Tom and I, it's a literal fact, that sat at the desk, and we took crayons, and we colored about a 200 miles strip from the coast to past Chongqing. And that's, by golly, what we used it. In Japan, we had maps.
On board the carrier, Colonel William Bauer and the rest of the crews studied the maps and selected their targets in Japan.
So we did become familiar with the country that we were going to face. And at that time, we picked targets that we thought were important. I picked the shipyard just south of the city of Japan, and that was my target. And what I did specifically was to figure out what I would see and how I would find it from making landfall on the island of Japan. That's what we did on board the carrier.
As the Hornet got closer to the planned launching point for the bombers, the crews began preparations for their departure. Colonel Glines explains this procedure.
They all had one takeoff point, which people don't realize. It wasn't as if they all, you know, as airplanes left, that they all had a greater depth. They had put a non-skid material on the deck for the starting point. And they all then moved up to that takeoff point.
And in theory, then, we were coming along later, and we could, incendiary's results would be helpful to us, guides. Well, and so we had, were organized by flights. The first flight, number 2, 3, and 4, were on the north part of the city. Second flight was 5, 6, was me, the second flight, and our targets were along the waterfront and so on down the line. And then the last three guys, one at a time, one airplane each at Kobe and Osaka and wherever the other city was, the three of them. We were, we'd get there at dusk, it was dark, and then it would be, we'd proceed, and we get to China, there at daybreak, refuel, go to Chongqing. It's just as simple as that.
Major General David Jones describes the initial outline for the Raiders' mission. At this time, the Japanese coast was covered with radio-equipped fishing boats, like the number 23 Nitomaru. General Doolittle recalls this close encounter.
Before we took off, we intercepted two Japanese patrol boats on the radar, but were able to maneuver the task force around them. Unfortunately, almost immediately we got started on a straight course. Just after daylight, we ran into two more Japanese patrol boats. They were fishing boats that carried high-power radio, and the Japanese coast had a great number of them out, and the task force promptly sank them, but not before they got a message off. The message got to shore saying that there was a task force of enemy ships out there, and the Japanese received the message, but waited for a confirmation, and the confirmation did not come because the two boats were sank before they could get the confirmation message off, and this permitted us to achieve almost complete surprise. I say almost complete surprise because some folks felt that there was something in the message, and so they were semi-alerted, but they did not take it seriously, and so they were not waiting for us in full strength.
Afraid the Japanese were now making preparations for a counterattack, Admiral William Halsey, task force commander on the carrier Enterprise, ordered Captain Mike Mitcher of the Hornet to launch the B-25s immediately, 10 hours early and 200 miles farther from Japan than planned. Colonel Glines explains.
Well, the plan was for the Navy to get them within 450 miles of the Japanese coast, but they responded at about 650 miles out. And Admiral Halsey told General Mitcher on the Hornet to launch those bombers. So Captain Mitcher gave the order over the loudspeaker, Army pilots, man your planes. Because the plan was that if they were close enough to go, if they're far enough that they couldn't make it to Japan, then they were to go to Midway Island. And they were being attacked at any time, the B-25s were to be pushed off into the ocean so the fighters could come up from the Hornet's desk. The other carrier, the Enterprise, had aircraft that they were able to disperse and dispense for patrols. And that was the reason then that they had to launch early, earlier than planned, 200 miles farther out than planned.
The pilot of Plane 5, Major General David Jones, recounts this change of plans.
We were picked up at daybreak, and the old man got off. We had the option to go or they throw us overboard. And it took an hour to get us all off. They had to tow us into position. And so we went individually. So we weren't in flights. We said we'd like 450. 650 was our limit. And we were 810 miles when they found us. So it didn't fit. We all had our individual targets for each damn bomb.
Lieutenant Colonel Richard Cole, then Lieutenant, and Jimmy Doolittle's co-pilot on Plane 1, reflects on this time.
Well, when they called General Quarters and said, Army pilots, man your plane, I wanted to make sure that I got to the airplane before Jimmy Doolittle, which I did. And I got there in time to help Paul Leonard pull the props through and so forth. I got in the airplane and did whatever I could on the checklist that he wouldn't have to repeat. And he showed up, and we cranked up and waited, and about 8:15 we launched. Yeah. And they had drawn a white line down for the main wheel, landing wheel, and they had drawn a white line down for the nose wheel. He fired it up, and away we went.
Although the initial plan had been aborted, Jimmy Doolittle remained in control. Colonel Glines explains.
Colonel Doolittle was first, and his nose wheel was off the ground almost as soon as he applied full power and released the brakes. You notice that his nose wheel was off, and he was off that deck. Well, he was the leader, and the fellas behind him, if they had any apprehensions, if the boss can do it, then we've got to do it.
The takeoff was no sweat. And the reason it was no sweat is we were making 20 knots into the 30-knot headwind, so there was a 50-knot wind across the deck, which was real good. The only thing we really worried about was a dead calm. With our overloaded airplanes, it would have been critical whether or not we could have gotten off in a dead calm. That we would just then have the speed of the carrier making a wind for us. The takeoff, as a matter of fact, was real easy. And each one of us, as we took off the carrier like this, turned around, circled the carrier, and came back and flew parallel to it in order to check our compass. The carrier held a perfect course, so we knew exactly where it was headed, gave us a final check on our compass, which, having sat on the deck for a couple of weeks, may well have gotten out. So each one of us had a compass check, and we were headed right toward our course when we paralleled the carrier deck. And the carrier was pitching badly. One airplane took off, unfortunately, on the upbeat, and as he came to the bow, he was tossed off, and he caught himself just before he hit the water. Another airplane taking off put his flaps down, thought he had put the flap lever back in neutral, but he had put it just past neutral, and the flaps milked up. So when he took off, he also settled almost to the wave, slapped his tail down, and went on. So the takeoffs were all successful. There was only one unfortunate incident, and one of the seamen endeavoring to maneuver the plane got in the prop and had one arm taken off at the shoulder with a propeller. That was the only casualty on takeoff.
General Doolittle describes his takeoff. Even though none of the pilots had actually flown off of a carrier, all of the planes launched safely. This marked the first time in history that United States Air Force Army bombers were launched from a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier on a combat mission. Lieutenant Colonel Richard Cole recalls his takeoff in Plane 1.
And I remember looking out the window just about the time we became airborne, and I think we had a good maybe 20, 30 feet before the end of the deck. And we took off and circled back over the ship, and they gave us a magnetic heading, and we took off on it toward Japan.
Colonel William Bauer, pilot of Plane 12, remembers his takeoff.
He said we could do it and showed us what we could do with that airplane, and then from there on it was a piece of cake. We knew the airplane could perform and do the job that he wanted us to do, and we just kept going. Of course, I was 12, and so I just taxied up to that line, and so I'm all by myself. I mean, my airplane, there's the deck ahead of me, and Hank Miller just gave me the signal to rev up my engines, and I did that. And then he gave the go signal. I just released the brakes and pulled the yoke back in my belly and held on, and all of a sudden we're gone. We're up off the deck and on our way. And we made a circle of the ship and took bearing set our compass on, I think it was 289. Seems to me that was the figure. I don't know where that came from, but it's registered in my mind. 289 was probably 290.
Though the takeoffs were all successful, Tom Griffin, navigator of Plane 9, explains the rest of the mission was not as easy.
The navigators on each of the 16 planes were qualified as celestial navigators. We had that training. But when we took off that morning, see, we hadn't planned to take off in the morning. We had to plan to take off late in the afternoon or early evening and celestial navigation all through the night. So here it was a daytime thing. And until we got about 2 hours off the carrier, the clouds covered us up and the clouds cleared. And the only thing we could use at that time of day was the sun. And I know in my case, I took sun lines and took them about three different times and got the same line and we flew right into Tokyo. That was our celestial part of the mission.
Major Ed Saylor, engineer gunner of Plane 15, recalls Doolittle's initial emergency escape plan.
We were supposed to take off at dusk, bomb during the night, land at dawn in an airstrip in China that had some gas. And, of course, the worst possible scenario, as the general said, if we have to take off early, get in there and drop your bombs and get out however you can. And that's what happened. The worst case is what happened.
On the way to the Japanese coast, I finally found 9 fighters that had formed on me and were just turning over to peel off and dive on me. And there were 2 little hills. And as these planes peeled off, I made a quick turn around one hill right on the deck, did an S-turn around the other hill, went on my way, and all of them turned around. They saw only the first turn, not the second, and started back the other way to my considerable pleasure.
Despite minor problems of the day, like Doolittle's brief enemy fighters encounter, the raid went as planned. His co-pilot, Lieutenant Colonel Richard Cole, describes the bombing.
We shored in Japan about 25 miles or 30 miles north of Tokyo. We could see it, see Tokyo Bay. On the way in, we flew underneath a Japanese four-engine flying boat. He didn't see us, I guess. Paul Leonard watched him until he disappeared behind us. We made a left turn and headed down across Tokyo. I wonder if you could see one of the main streets. And people waved at us, and we passed over several schools, and the kids were out playing baseball or volleyball. And when Fred Bramer saw something that he was going to use for his initial IP point, Colonel Doolittle pulled the airplane up to 1,500 feet, and Fred dropped the bomb, and we had an incendiary bomb because we were supposed to launch on the 19th and light up Tokyo at night, but that didn't happen.
Tokyo, oddly enough, had just completed an air raid drill. Their patrol boat had warned the city, but the attack was expected the next day. Therefore, the Jap war machine rolled on, unmindful of the approaching eagle. Target factories were churning out munitions tagged for Corregidor, Midway, and Dutch Harbor. Secure behind their Pacific fortress and confident of an early victory, they discounted America's ability to fight back.
Thus, the bombers were virtually unopposed as they flew on the deck. They swept in over the coast on their way to Tokyo. Elements separated and sounded deep for the bombers. At 12:15, the attack was opened by Doolittle, who dove in before he unloaded his incendiaries upon the Japanese capital. One after another, they checked off their targets. Tank factory, shipyard, docks, railroad yards, steel plant, gunpowder factory.
The raiders successfully bombed 10 military and industrial sites in Tokyo, 2 in Yokohama, and 1 each in Nagoya, Kobe, Osaka, and Yokosuka. Although some B-25s encountered light anti-aircraft fire and a few enemy fighters over Japan, the only plane to receive any minor battle damage was Plane 10, under the command of Lieutenant Richard Joyce. Colonel William Bauer and General Jimmy Doolittle explain their individual experiences in the bombings.
After we reached Tokyo, we went to the place we were supposed to go, flew and identified the shipyards, that's what I was after, dropped the bombs, and went back on down on the deck and throttled back to 1,170 RPM and whatever manifold pressure it took to make 130 knots, and just sat there for another 10 or 15 hours, just above the water, just down the coast of Japan, and finally across the China Sea, and then out into the... And when we made landfall, we then climbed up to 7,000 or 8,000 feet, I guess it was, and just eased it up, and those engines were just going like this. They were just barely making just above stall speed for all those. I don't think we ever got above 140.
Our target was a factory. We were right on the deck, just as close as we dared fly, pulling up over houses, over trees, over telephone lines, staying right on the deck because we didn't know whether they had radar or not. We wanted to stay under it. But in order to bomb, we had to pull up to about 1,500 feet, first to get some dispersal of the incendiary bombs, and second to be above the damaging effect of our demolition bombs. So we pulled up to 1,500 feet, dropped the bombs right back on the deck again. All used the same activity. Started south then, low and fast, and passed over an aircraft factory, aircraft on the line. There was a temptation to strafe them, but we resisted it. We didn't want to call attention to the planes that were behind us, feeling that if we could get away with a minimum of alerting the enemy, the other planes would have a better chance. So came to the beach, and along the beach, driving right on a road along the beach, was an Army truck. And we were right on the deck, and as the Army truck saw this airplane coming, we saw them stop and everybody peel out. But by the time they got lined up with their rifles, we were out of range. We started then out over the ocean on a course to the south in order to confuse the Japs as to where we were going. We didn't want to head right for China. And we hadn't been going very far to the south when Paul Leonard, the gunner in the back, said, there's another plane on a collision course with us, and he's overtaking us. Well, I'd slowed down by then. And the question was this a friendly plane or an enemy plane? It turned out to be Travis Hoover, the second plane off, who had formed on me and flown all the way with me, and had only left in order to get his target, and then had reformed.
Major Tom Griffin recalls the bombing from Plane 9.
After we bombed our targets in Japan, it was about noon now when we got there, because their ships had found our boys coming across, our ships. They knew we were coming. And we flew in, and about noontime, separately, about 4 or 5 minutes apart, we had no chance of forming into formation because that took up too much gas. So each plane went in on its own, and we never saw another B-25 that day. For example, we were in plane number 9, and when we got over Tokyo, we found the fires and smoke and all from the 8 planes that had gone in there ahead of us and bombed targets there. Mm-hmm. But we were all about 4 minutes apart, just far enough apart. We never saw another B-25 that day.
Tune in for part 2 of America Strikes Back, the story of the Doolittle Raid, to hear how the bombers made it to Japan. To hear part 2 and many other documentaries, visit www.americanveteranscenter.org.